Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, the messages that exercise sends to your body and the implications for Australia from a medical tragedy in the UK, which has doctors around the world anxious and angry. It's even upset politicians. It involves the terrible and possibly preventable death of a six-year-old boy. The junior doctor who looked after him was Dr. Hadiza Bawagarba, a British-trained paediatric registrar in Leicester. She has been convicted of manslaughter, given a two-year suspended jail sentence, removed from England's junior doctor training register, and in the last 2 weeks has been removed, struck off the medical register permanently. Here's the British Secretary of State for Health, Jeremy Hunt, speaking in the House of Commons last week.
Mr. Speaker, on the day we mark the 100th anniversary of giving a voice to women, I want to update the House on concerns in the medical profession we may not be giving a voice to doctors and other clinicians who want the freedom to be able to learn from mistakes. As a government minister, the House will know I can't comment on a court ruling, but it is fair to say that the recent Dr. Bawagarba case has caused huge concern. So today I can announce that I've asked Professor Sir Norman Williams, former President of the Royal College of Surgeons, my senior clinical adviser, to conduct a rapid review into the application of gross negligence manslaughter in healthcare. Working with senior lawyers, Sir Norman will review how we ensure the vital role of reflective learning, openness and transparency is protected so that mistakes are learned from and not covered up, how we ensure there is clarity about where the line is drawn between gross negligence, manslaughter and ordinary human error in medical practice so that doctors and other health professionals know where they stand with respect to criminal liability or professional misconduct, and any lessons that need to be learned by the General Medical Council and other professional regulators. I will engage the devolved administrations, the Justice Secretary and Professional Standards Authority for Health and Social Care in this vital review, which will report to me before the end of April 2018.
The story goes back to 2011 when Jack Adcock, a six-year-old with Down syndrome, congenital heart disease and heart failure, controlled by a medication called enalapril, was admitted to Leicester Royal Infirmary after 24 hours of being sick. He had diarrhoea and vomiting, shallow breathing and looked very unwell. The registrar on for acute paediatrics that day was UK-trained Dr. Hadiza Bawagarba, just back from 14 months maternity leave. It was her first day on duty for acutely sick children in an unfamiliar hospital. Her consultant was in another town initially, and she was doing the work of at least one other paediatric registrar who was on leave. That meant Dr. Bawagarba was covering various parts of the hospital, including maternity, taking calls for GPs, and dealing with other emergencies. The ward was short of nurses, and instead of some of the regular ones, there were agency nurses on duty. The hospital IT system was down, so doctors had to spend time chasing pathology results on the phone. Anyway, Dr. Bawagarba saw Jack mid-morning and thought he was ill from gastro, put him on IV fluids and ordered blood tests and a chest x-ray. One blood test, called blood gases, showed that his blood was too acid, which is a sign of acute illness, but that improved later in the morning after the fluids. The chest x-ray, however, didn't happen for about 2 hours from admission, and it took a while longer for Dr. Bawagarba to find time to read it, and when she did, she realised Jack actually had pneumonia. She wrote him up for antibiotics, but they weren't given to him for another hour. Dr. Bawagarba's consultant was back in the hospital around this time. He was shown Jack's blood gases, but didn't see him or suggest any change to care. Now, you might recall that I told you that Jack was on a drug called enalapril for his heart failure. This takes stress off the heart and lowers blood pressure, but must not be used when someone is in shock, like Jack. The medical term shock means that someone has lost fluids or blood and is having trouble maintaining enough output from their heart to stay alive. Dr. Bawagarba knew that enalapril should not be given and had deliberately not written Jack up for the drug. But despite the fact that there was no prescription, someone gave Jack enalapril anyway, and he went into cardiac arrest. When Dr. Bawagarba arrived at the resuscitation, she thought it was another child who had a do not resuscitate order and called off the resus. Another junior doctor present corrected the misunderstanding, and efforts were resumed a minute later, but they failed to revive Jack. Now, what I've told you is almost a textbook description of the process that leads to serious and heart-rending medical mistakes. Ironically, one of the people who pioneered research and thinking into human and system errors in healthcare is just up the road from Leicester at the University of Manchester, Professor James Reason. Here is James Reason talking to me on the Health Report 13 years ago and 6 years before Jack Adcock's tragic death.
When you start to think beyond slips and lapses, beyond absent-mindedness, beyond mistakes, beyond the single person, no one error, no one technical failure can usually achieve a disaster. It takes an often diabolical combination of factors coming together, often with tiny windows of opportunity for these defences to be penetrated and for hazards to come in damaging contact with victims and environment and so on.
Which is why people such as you say that it's easy to blame the individual for the lapse, but the system has got to have gone wrong, usually, for a disaster to happen.
Well, if you blame the individual, a lot of bad things follow, really. I must first of all say that blaming is something that's a delicious emotion. We all enjoy it, you know, and there's an enormous number of psychological factors which lead you to blame, particularly if there's been a bad outcome. You know, there's a thing that children believe, the just world hypothesis, that bad things happen to bad people and so forth. So blaming itself is a very satisfying emotion, but there is no remedial benefit from it. There's a man.
I might feel better for a moment, but nothing positive happens.
Managers like it, of course, because they can separate an individual, an erring individual, from the system, and they can uncouple the responsibility and put the blame onto the individual. Lawyers like it because, it's, at least in the UK, it's very hard to prosecute organisations, management. However, the real problem lies in the fact that, and this is the essence, I think, of error management, is that the same situation keeps on producing the same error in different people. Now, if you isolate the person from the context within the system, the workplace, the environment in which the error occurred, you will never recognise the error trap.
And what happened next is exactly what James Reason said should not happen. The parents were understandably beside themselves with grief and anger. There doesn't appear to have been an apology given to them around that time, and they wanted justice for what had happened to their little boy. Dr. Baba Garba's consultant, however, did take a leaf out of the James Reason book and encouraged her to write down what had happened and document the errors in her electronic training journal. The police were called in and initially felt there wasn't enough for a prosecution, but eventually it did come to court 4 years later, and Dr. Baba Garba and one of the nurses, Isabel Amaro, were convicted of manslaughter and given suspended jail sentences for gross negligence. Dr. Baba Garba was refused leave to appeal. A few months later, an independent panel called the Medical Practitioners Tribunal, taking the circumstances into account, gave Dr. Baba Garba a 12-month suspension from the medical register. Isabel Amaro, the nurse, has also been struck off the nursing register. It has to be said that Dr. Baba Garba was considered a good doctor before and after the event, as she continued to practice until the conviction several years later. The General Medical Council, which is the UK's overarching regulator of doctors, thought that the 12-month suspension was inadequate and appealed the decision to the High Court of England and Wales, who found in favour of the GMC and struck off Dr. Baba Garba for life. That decision was handed down just a few weeks ago at the end of January. The outrage in the UK and around the world has been considerable. On the line from Britain is Dr. Musa Qureshi, one of the three doctors who formed Team Hadiza, who raised over £300,000 in crowdfunding for Dr. Baba Garba's legal battles. Musa is a haematology trainee near the end of his training, a cancer researcher at the University of Cambridge, and also has a law degree. In our Sydney studio is Dr. Andrew MacDonald, a consultant paediatrician from Southwest Sydney. And I should declare, once upon a time was my paediatric resident when I was a hapless paediatric registrar. Andrew is a former New South Wales state politician and was Parliamentary Secretary for Health and later Shadow Minister for Health, but is now back in paediatric practice. And in our Melbourne studio is Dr. Joanna Flynn, who chairs Australia's nearest equivalent of the General Medical Council, the Medical Board of Australia. Jo has had a lot of involvement in doctors' training and chairs the Board of Eastern Health in Melbourne, which includes Box Hill Hospital. In her spare time, Jo is also a general practitioner. Welcome to you all. Musa, there were mistakes made here, and Hadiza made several of them herself, did she not?
Thank you, Norman. Yes, definitely. Nobody is contradicting the idea that Hadiza did make some mistakes on the day. However, I think two key features are actually particularly causing outrage amongst the medical profession in the UK. Firstly, the sort of pressures that she was put under. I've worked for 10 years in the UK, including some of the most intensive environments, in hospital environments in the UK. And I've never faced a day such as, you know, as reported as her having faced that day. She was literally covering at certain points the jobs of four doctors, covering six wards, spanning four floors, including surgical patients and midwives and taking GP calls, as you mentioned. And the situation she was in was a situation which really was going to produce mistakes. And it wasn't only herself who was making those mistakes, though most of the blame seems to have been pinned on her. And the second really alarming feature of this case is that mistakes happen in medicine, but the way that we stop those mistakes repeating themselves is that we have a culture of open learning. We share our mistakes, we reflect on them, and we learn from them. And one of the particularly alarming features of this case is that it seems that Dr. Hadisa's reflections on her mistakes were used against her in court. And in the long term, that's going to be damaging to patient safety across the UK.
Of course, the General Medical Council denies that the notes were used there, although it accepts that they might have been used in the Medical Practitioners Tribunal, which, to be fair, gave a much more lenient decision. Now, the GMC says, you know, that, well, the General Medical Council says, well, you know, when doctors are under this kind of pressure, they should simply note it in the notes and just make sure it's noted they're not supported, but don't stop working.
So looking at that piece of advice from the GMC, it's rather disingenuous, because we know that there are several cases where doctors, on the other hand, and this is, again, another alarming feature of what's happening in UK medical healthcare, doctors, on the other hand, have raised the alarm and have blown the whistle. And those doctors have also lost their careers. So I'm very closely involved with a doctor, Chris Day, who is quite a famous whistleblower, and is one of the other doctors who's helped Dr. Hadisa raise £300,000 for her case. And he's on the other end of the spectrum. He raised the alarm about a dangerously understaffed ITU department, and he's lost his career as a result of that. Yes, intensive care. And he's lost his career as a result of that. And the GMC are very, very highly aware of his case.
How is Hadisa going?
So I have spoken to Hadisa. She is generally obviously this entire case was devastating for her, particularly when she was literally in shock when she was in the GMC hearing, because she couldn't believe that the General Medical Council, who really should know better, were taking her to court. But she is in remarkably good spirit. She has a very strong, stable family structure around her, which is supporting her. And she's particularly grateful for all the donations from the public. Her career is effectively over, in the sense that the GMC has permanently erased her from the register. But more than that, we know that even where this, you know, whistleblowing doctors and doctors who undergo this sort of experience that Hadisa is undergoing, even if they are put back on the medical register, effectively this sort of incident does, you know, destroy their career.
Andrew McDonald, what's your analysis of this from an Australian perspective?
Jack Adcock's tragedy was caused by a system that was clearly not fit for purpose. It's got everything that James Reason said could go wrong. It's got inadequate supervision, a ridiculous workload, haphazard work environment, a vulnerable child, and a severe illness. This is a perfect storm. And as James Reason said, the same outcome with different people will produce the same result.
Do you think it could happen here?
It certainly happens here. It happens here around twice a week.
Twice a week?
Twice a week in Australia, there is a serious adverse event in healthcare in Australia, child or adult. This already happens here. Most active consultants will have had personal experience of a case such as this.
What's your reading of the consultant here? Because it wasn't the consultant on trial yet. The consultant didn't see the child, and Dr. Hadisa was criticised because she didn't call him in, but she showed him the blood gases.
As a jobbing consultant myself, this supervision was clearly inadequate. A pH of 7.08 is the reddest of red flags, and this consultant has failed in his duty of care to provide safe care to this child.
Why do you think he wasn't brought before?
I have no idea why he wasn't brought before the court, but before the court of his peers, consultants, to not go and see a child with a pH of 7.08 with an unexplained illness is just hopeless.
Now, you say this happens twice a week here in Australia. We don't have two manslaughter cases a week in Australia of doctors. What's in place in the Australian situation? Because again, Australian doctors look at the General Medical Council and think, gosh, they're pretty vicious. And we'll come to Joe Flynn in a minute about the Medical Board of Australia. What happens when one of these things happens in Australia?
We are better at medical error. This was a case of a clear system error, and we're better at identifying system errors and not reacting to them, as in this case.
So what happens?
Basically, this child was let down by the system his parents depended on because the care was inadequate.
But what would be the process of investigation here?
In Australia, in New South Wales, this would be a root cause analysis.
Which is what they did at Leicester Royal Infirmary.
Yes.
They actually did that.
Yes, it would be done by the same people, but the outcome I expect would be different. The New South Wales Medical Board or APRA are not perfect, but I've never seen anything as vindictive and poorly informed as this.
You could feel sympathetic towards Hadiza about this, but if it doesn't happen here, why care?
The reason is this could be any of us. The reason every junior doctor in Australia is worried about this case is because this could be any of us. The senior doctors at Westmead have sent an email to all their doctors saying to call them at any time. This situation could be any of us because situations such as affected Hadiza could and have occurred to most junior and senior doctors at some stage.
And this business of taking notes and writing down the error and then having it allegedly used back against you?
Well, we don't do it much in senior doctors. It's being introduced to medical schools, and this will put that cause back many years.
In other words, you should be encouraged to be transparent and encouraged to learn from your mistakes.
Absolutely, you learn by your mistakes. However, the use of the reflection is a major issue.
Joe Flynn, has this happened here ever where a doctor has been charged with manslaughter?
I understand, Norman, that there have been a handful of cases over perhaps 50 years. It's extremely rare that there's a conviction. So to give you an example, Dr. Jayant Patil from Bundaberg was charged with medical manslaughter and initially convicted, but that conviction was quashed. And on retrial, he was acquitted. So he was a pretty extreme example, well known in the Australian community, of a doctor who went by the name of Dr. Death, but he wasn't convicted of medical manslaughter. I'm giving you that example to show how rare it is in Australia.
So what's the role of the regulator here in Australia? When would you be called in, and what would you do?
I think in terms of trying to learn from errors, we recognise bad things happen, and there are questions to be asked about to what degree it is a system issue and to what degree individuals are accountable. And that obviously depends on the precise context. And I think we're learning more and more, as you've said, in the last couple of decades about how much it's about the system. But in this case, I'd imagine there would be, if a similar set of circumstances happened, as you said, there'll be an investigation in the hospital. But then there would probably be a coronial process, and there'd be recommendations out of that, and there might be a civil suit against the hospital. But in terms of...
And it is easier to sue hospitals in Australia than it is in Britain, I think.
Yep, that may be so.
But the parents might have made a complaint to you, either
yes.
to the local board or the national board. Your role is to protect the public from dangerous doctors, really, and make sure they're safe. You don't have any control over the system in the same way as a coroner doesn't have any control. I mean, your only power is over the doctor, isn't it?
That's right. So
what can you do?
The medical board with APRA is responsible for regulating doctors. So if a complaint was made or the coroner criticised an individual practitioner, APRA would conduct an investigation and the board would decide whether the matter should be looked at as terms of unprofessional conduct, professional misconduct, or unsatisfactory professional performance.
Where does open disclosure fit with this? We should explain that this is, and I think they call it candor in the United Kingdom. That's right, Musa, isn't it?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
So you're supposed to go and apologise and say a problem occurred. And lawyers get very, very nervous about this, Joanna Flynn, don't they? Saying, well, you're going to give it all away and admit culpability.
It's a really, really important issue. So there is a process of open disclosure in Australia. And in fact, in Victoria, there's a proposal to introduce candour as a legislative requirement, which means that patients must be told if something bad has happened, why it happened, what's been learnt from it, how it can be prevented. And there are protections so that explanation about what happened and even acknowledgement that something went wrong can't be used in litigation against the doctor in the context of an apology.
Andrew McDonald, just finally, before I come back to Musa, is it going to change your practice?
Absolutely.
So it will change your practice?
This absolutely confirms that every child should be seen every day at consultant level, as didn't happen in this case. And if you're in a hospital where your consultant's more than 30 minutes away, you are not providing safe care.
So people need to know that. Musa, what's the next step in Dr. Hadiza's legal battle? Is it all closed or can she appeal the High Court decision?
So just before I answer that question, I'd like to emphasise that this is a tragic, avoidable death of a young six-year-old boy. And really, you know, our hearts go out to the family of the young boy who's died needlessly. But as various of your as the other members of your panel have suggested, this is actually a systems failure. The next steps are that we have basically Hadiza has been able to instruct a new legal team with all the funds that have been donated very generously. She has instructed one of the top employment barristers in the UK, and the next step will be to make an appeal against the GMC's decision to erase her from the medical register. The criminal conviction will be much, much more difficult because it is a conviction by a jury in a criminal court, and that is always problematic. And it's just very unfortunate that things have got to such an advanced stage in the legal process that they'll be very difficult to overturn now.
Do you get any sense that the system's learned anything?
It's very difficult to say. There are sort of economic and political forces at play, which we can't go into here, but I fear that this is actually a trend rather than a glitch. And just one thing I would like to mention is that just to put into context how common this sort of mistake is, we know, for instance, that the ex-president of the GMC himself, Sir Graham Cato, very eminent clinician, has openly admitted that when he was in training, he missed the diagnosis of a patient who had a blood infection. And he himself has said that that young man developed meningitis and died. Now, these things happen all the time in medical practice. And if we respond to them in this way, we're really, really going to actually make things much worse because doctors are going to start feeling fearful of actually admitting mistakes. And if that happens, then mistakes cannot be corrected and avoided in future.
Musa, thanks for joining us. And we'll watch
this
case with interest. Musa Qureshi, Andrew McDonald, thank you. And thanks to Joe Flynn in Melbourne. You're listening to The Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. I'm Norman Swan. A complete change of pace now to some surprising effects of exercise on the body. You know how when you hear an exercise enthusiast talking, they make the benefits of physical activity almost too good to be true, from life extension to diabetes reduction to cancer prevention and added years of life? Well, research findings from the Garvan Institute in Sydney may support these contentions. They've discovered crosstalk from our muscles to other parts of the body. They call it trafficking. Martin Whittam leads the Garvan's Myokine Biology Group, and he's in our Sydney studio. Welcome, Martin.
Hello, Noel.
What was known before you started this study?
In terms of exercise.
Yeah, and this crosstalk stuff.
So we've known for a while that individual proteins secreted from muscle, for example, to have effects on distal tissues such as the liver. But trying to tease those out from the blood is really difficult. Blood is very, very complex. And trying to tease out individual proteins that might be doing this function has been quite technically challenging up to now.
So what did you do in this study?
So it was quite typical in terms of the exercise model. We took blood pre and post exercise from some volunteer adults on a bicycle. But the way in which we analysed the blood was quite unconventional. So we used what is called a mass spectrometer to analyse the sample. So what the mass spec gives you is not only, so for example, you might have one or two or three proteins that you might be interested in. The mass spec analysis allows you to analyze hundreds, thousands of proteins at once. So when we analyzed the post-exercise blood samples, we were able to identify a really large number of proteins that we know make up very small vesicles.
sort of little bubbles of stuff in the blood.
Yeah, so about just over a billionth of a metre in size. They're incredibly small, but they, well, they're known to contain things like genetic material, RNAs, proteins and lipid, and importantly, they can transfer those molecules from cell to cell.
So they're talking to other cells in the body?
Correct.
What are they doing? So which cells do they go? Where do they go in the body?
So,
just summarise then, because sure. It's complicated stuff. So you're out there, you're cycling on the bike, you're taking these blood samples, and you're finding these vesicles being thrust out, and they're going somewhere. Where are they going?
So we've done some analysis in mice. So if we transplant vesicles from an exercised mouse into a recipient mouse, we can actually, using some biological tracking, see which tissues they are taken into. And first of all, where the deep vesicles go in from an exercised donor is very different from vesicles taken from a resting donor. And we do see quite a strong uptake of vesicles to the liver.
Why would the liver make a difference here? What's the implication?
Well, the liver is a very important organ in the context of energy provision. Since we see a lot of metabolic enzymes that are packaged within these vesicles, it is conceivably a way in which the body can communicate with the liver during the metabolic stress of exercise to alter its function.
So this is where glycogen is stored, so that you can release carbohydrate to turn into glucose.
Correct. That's right.
But what about all the other stuff that exercise people tell you, that it makes you less, more resistant to cancer, reverses diabetes? I mean, are these vesicles going to the pancreas and influencing insulin? Or are they going to the brain? Are they affecting the immune system? Do we know?
So again, the power of this work is that we know quite a large number of proteins that are shuttled within these vesicles during exercise now. And if you look at the biological processes that they're involved in or known to be involved in, there's a huge range of biological processes that these proteins do. So what we're really excited about is really going a bit deeper and finding out what else is transferred. And I think what we're really excited about is trying to find out what is channeled, where it goes, and what it does in the recipient.
So it changes the concept that really when you exercise, your heart goes up and your muscles get stronger, but in fact it's affecting your whole body.
It gives us a nice framework to study the biology of exercise.
And is it just any exercise, casual? I mean, were these people doing high-intensity interval training and really pushing their muscles, or is it just you go out for a walk around the park with your dog, will these get released at the same time?
So these guys were exhausted when they finished, but we haven't done the studies yet, but I think we'd like to think that...
So you were really squeezing the muscles.
That's right. But yeah, I think it's nice you do get adaptations to like, as you say, walk in the park. So we're really keen to do the experiments to find out if vesicle release is significant during the smallest of exercise.
And what happens if you knacker yourself and the next day you knacker yourself again? Do you produce fewer vesicles, that you kind of knacker your muscles' ability to produce these extra cellular vesicles?
Again, we have to do the studies.
So you don't know whether you can squeeze the lemon too much?
We'd like to think so.
Martin, thanks for joining us.
That's
a big contrast to Dr. Hadiza, but it was deliberately so. Martin Whittam, who is the group leader, Myokine Biology, at the Garvan Institute of Medical Research in Sydney. I'm Norman Swan. This has been the Health Report. Do join me next week.